I was just a part of that whole northern movement that failed for King. And what else is important? I have five kids from 15 to 52, and nine grandkids, and very successful kids. They've made it in terms of everybody's notion of making it, even though I had one kid who flunked out of Oberlin twice. And signal distinction, I think, that he flunked out of the same college twice. And he's now, you know, I mean, he can name his salary in the computer field almost. And he's very active in a thing called the Forum, which is human engineering thing growing out of Werner Erhard and the S activity. Very constructive, and he tries to really construct my life and the family. I mean, it's unbelievable. He went from being on drugs when he was 35 to this very constructive person. So I just thank God for not anything I did, certainly. And I spent a quarter of a century at the University of Chicago teaching Christian social ethics. And as some people said, I was an observer participant. You know, they talk about a participant observer where you kind of observe and participate a little. They call me an observer participant in the civil rights movement because I spent so much time there. I spent from 30 to 90 hours a week for 5 or 6 years while I was teaching. Every quarter off, every summer, you know, I'd spend my complete existence trying to do something. So, there are probably some other things. Now, we'll roll the tape.
I think you got it on.
Yeah, this session is the second session on creation communities, why and how. And I'm Al Pitcher. So, I don't know why I left it there, but he was in here. What I want to talk about is how we hear the voice of God. And it's my assumption that we hear the voice of God through the creation, through and in and by virtue of attending to the creation. And there are a number of scriptural passages that would support this position that God is in the creation. There's one in Romans, and you can find all kinds of support for it. But it's not our traditional way of doing theology, although the Roman Catholics both have a kind of scriptural base and a kind of philosophical base in which they look at the world and experience and generalize from it. And so they have two sources. For the most part, we Protestants have been biblically oriented, and it's my contention that we need to look at the whole world. Now, the assumption that I start with about the nature of the world that we're looking at comes out of a long study of both the Bible and of philosophy. But from the Bible, I come out of 1 Corinthians 12. Where Paul says, if you are in Christ, you belong to a body, you're part of a body, and the hand can't say to the ear or any part of the body, you don't belong, or I don't belong to you, because we all belong together. And those final words there, where if anybody suffers, we all suffer. If anybody is honored, we all rejoice. So I say, when each of those 40,000 kids who die today and died yesterday, 40,000 yesterday, 40,000 tomorrow, because of hunger or hunger-related diseases, that part of us dies. I really believe that. I really believe that we are connected. We are connected by a world that we can't see. And the physicists are now saying the same thing. Are saying that there are all kinds of connections. Something can happen here, and every time it happens here, something will happen here, and there's no obvious connection. No obvious connection. Prigogine, Order Out of Chaos, History of Science, and he develops this thesis. Everything is connected. Everything is connected. And Paul says it, that we're all connected. Now, he doesn't say we're all connected in our kind of natural state, but if we're in Christ, through whom and in whom and by whom everything was created that was created, prologue to the Gospel of John, if we're in Christ, then we, in some sense, act out of, feel. And I must admit, it's very hard to feel those kids dying. It's very hard to participate in that. But that's my fundamental assumption, that we belong to each other, to the universe, to the human and the non-human world. We're connected. Now, on Monday, I discussed the environmental revolution as the voice of God. How many were here Monday? Anybody who was here Monday? No? Nope. Well, then I can kind of review that. The evidence of, for me, and only for me, for some others, but not for everybody, convinces me that we are threatened with a physical, chemical, biological destruction of the basis for life. Ozone depletion resulting in destruction of immune systems, of eyesight, of plant life, much of, they say, it affects the buildings, the materials in the buildings are destroyed. It costs millions, billions of dollars. At any rate, the ozone destruction and the resulting increase in ultraviolet rays in Australia during the winter, when the ozone hole seems to spread out from the Antarctica, they keep the kids in school from 10 until 3. They won't let them out even during that time because they are aware of the effect of this ozone depletion. The climate change, you know, it's very tempting for me to see what's happening in the United States today as an effect of what we are doing to the greenhouse gases. What the students predict is that we will have all kinds of changes in our rainfall patterns, all kinds of changes in our temperature patterns, all kinds of changes in our wind patterns with destructive storms. That's what they predict if the temperature rises. And it hasn't risen enough to make any connection, but you wonder. And I was wondering today, well, what's happening around the rest of the world? Because you would think if this is due to the what's happened to the greenhouse gases, you would expect it to affect the whole world. Soil erosion, losing 4 billion tons of soil a year. Some of the soil is becoming salty. Practices irrigation, where the irrigation doesn't drain the salts remain in the soil and the fertilizers remain in the soil. Species depletion, forest destruction, water quality problems. If you read the New York Times for the 19th of July, just read it this morning, and the new studies indicate that, but they say, and of course it's debated, 50 to 60,000 people die in the United States every year from what they call particle pollution. It's not the pollution that comes from the sulfurs and the nitrogens, but it's just small particles, and it's particularly effective in causing problems in children, according to the article. And I only know really the same that you know by virtue of what I read. Mineral depletion, prediction is that we have about 1 trillion barrels of oil and we're using it up at the rate of $6 billion a year in this country, and $24 billion in the year. Well, you divide 24 into 1 trillion, and what do you get? You know, you get about 40. Now, say you double or triple the resources. So you get 80, 120 years of oil. Population explosion. I don't know what to do with the population explosion. It's so drastic in terms of its implications. And I have some figures here that indicate we'll be, by 2025, we'll be about 8.3 billion. And 8.3 billion. And Mexico will go from 88.6 million in 1990 to 150 million in 2025. If we think we have problems with the border, I mean, just from a straight instrumental point of view, nothing to do with the destruction of life that happens in a country like Mexico when its population already, you know, in Mexico City with, what, 25 million people and living without running water in most places and in all kinds of conditions that are all inhuman, let alone what happens there, just from a point of view of our own self-interest. Texas border, if it's a problem now, and the same thing, of course, is happening in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, and the rest of the countries. El Salvador from 5.3 to 11.3 million, Guatemala from 9.2 to 21.7, Nicaragua from 3.9 to 9.2. If those countries have problems now, which we don't know how to handle, except by, for the most part, giving them military aid so they can keep the lid on the dissatisfaction of those who are oppressed in those countries, what will it be in the future? I put the population in there because the population is so related to forest destruction, for example, in the third world countries. The people are tearing down the forests. One study showed that it takes 55 feet of forest in Brazil to create one fast food hamburger. 55 square feet. They clear the forest, they get about 3 to 4 years of life out of the forest because there isn't much food value in the forest, and then they figure how many cattle you can raise. And you know, it's of course only an indication of the depth and character of the problem. Now, I asserted on Monday that these realities could be listened to, should be listened to, as the voice of God saying something to us about what we're about. And I say, they say no to much of what we spend our lives getting and spending, acquiring and using. Now, it's easy to say no. The question is what to say yes to. But I think we're at a time very much like the Reformation, that Luther had to say no to a church that he thought was demonic. I think we almost have to be born again into an awareness of the creation, and particularly the non-human creation. And we have to say no. No. Luther said no to the church, to the Roman Catholic Church, because he thought it was demonic, because they were selling a kind of salvation, as if somehow you could buy your way into heaven or buy your way into God's grace. And he thought that was absolutely demonic. Well, there's a sense in which I think that the Western civilization, in its search for more and more goods, more and more consumption, more and more things, more and more military might is demonic. Now, today I'm claiming that we can hear the same voice if we listen to what is being said to us by the poverty, violence, and racism or ethnocentrism of our society, and by the poverty, violence, and ethnocentrism of other societies. Now, we hear the same no, I think, because we hear the word that we are acting as if we were somehow isolated, unrelated, unresponsible for whole segments of our reality and whole segments of our population. Whole segments are treated as if they were not human, as if they did not belong to us and we to them. I've just finished reading Toni Morrison's Beloved. It's almost too much. I'm not sure I get all the depth of what she's saying because it's so elliptical, but some of it is so clear in terms of how African Americans have been treated in this country and how they are continuing to be treated. Now, I'm convinced that we cannot hear the voice of God unless we listen. And I have a book that's coming out soon called Listen to the Crying of the Earth, The Cultivation of Creation Communities. Listen to the Crying of the Earth. And how do we listen to the crying of the earth? And I've become quite directive, you know, and frequently say, and I'll have the Bible in one hand, and I'll have a state of the world on the other. Of course, it comes out of Karl Barth. He used to put the newspaper in one hand, the Bible in the other, and he says, you cannot hear the word of God unless you listen to both. Because you've got to pay attention to what is going on in the world. You have to deal with history as well as in the present as well as the past. State of the world. Every year they put out a state of the world. The opponents of us so-called echo freaks and opponents of this interpretation of what is going on would of course say that the author of this, or the Lester Brown, who's kind of a sponsor for the World Watch Institute, has been crying wolf for years and nothing has happened in accordance with his prediction, dire predictions. But I think this is a kind of a must. You could get the same kind of thrust out of Al Gore's book, Earth in the Balance. And I've got some magazines over here, which I suggest that you know, there's one on creation spirituality, and the Mises is from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and there's another one from the World Watch Institute I don't have. And my wife says I brought too much junk anyway. And now I didn't bring Garbage. Garbage is another magazine, but I think everyone should read this every year, and I think somehow we need to get the church involved in reading that. Need to buy some copies, and give your pastor one, give some key people, get a conversation going, and maybe you've got it going. Some churches have a lot going, and I gave to you, there were some copies of this thing from the Riverside Church. The Riverside Church is the most, I think, the most comprehensive, progressive, quote unquote, responsible, that's a better word, responsible church I know of in terms of what their task force at least proposed. I don't know what's, it's one thing to propose and it's another to carry out. But this statement, which I recommend that you think about in terms of your own churches, is kind of model. I think I put out another statement there that our own church worked out in terms of a kind of inventory of church life, how you begin to look at your church life. That's over on this table. I didn't put it out for everybody to take. I was not trying to force all this stuff on you. But then there's this this publication of the Children's Defense Fund. It's a little old now. A Vision for America's Future, which is an attempt to think about responsibility for America's children. And again, if we're really serious, I think if we believe somehow that everybody belongs to us and we belong to everybody, we got to do something about it in very concrete terms. And it's going to intervene in our ordinary way of living. In our community, we got rid of one of our dumpsters, $60 a month we saved, but we had to push people to recycle a little, and then we had to offer to recycle their organic stuff. So we recycle about 50 pounds, like Holden does, we recycle about 50 pounds out of our building every week of organic material. Well, we had to find a place to put it, you know, and so we've got we call it the brickyard, because every year you dig up more bricks. What they did was bulldoze a building. It's against the law, but that's what they did. So we got 15 families working there, and we've got the compost bin, and I collect the compost when I'm there, or organize the collection. And you have to push your people a little, and it involves doing things differently in all kinds of ways. Anyway, then I have this Race Matters, which I think it's a short book. You can read it in a couple of hours, and yet Derek Bell's book is more enigmatic, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. We just had a series in our church, six sessions on racism, revisited racism in the 90s. And we're going to do something about it. We had tremendous interest in it. We have an integrated church. We took in a black church. That's the only way we got integrated. I don't know how you attract African-American people to a white church. So we just took in a whole church and have been working at making it work ever since. And our community, our intentional community, is integrated, but it is work. We're accused of being racist by some of our African-American members all the time. So the principle I'm saying is there's no way to hear the voice of God through the Bible alone, unless your church leadership and your church lay people are involved seriously. And I say with focus, because you can't get involved in anything with focus, you will not hear the voice of God. Not in quotation marks. With God, everything is possible. But I'd say you're unlikely. Now, I don't claim that these are the books to read, but I claim our seminaries ought to educate our pastors till they were involved in something concrete. Some aspect of our concrete life. We spent in our church about 10 years on Central America. We had 25 people in Central America. We had the assistant to the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador from our group in our church for 3.5 years with his family. We have had two sanctuary families from Guatemala. We still are supporting the one family in numerous ways. And we had a special budget, $25,000 a year, as a special staff person in order to attend to that reality. And you will find on the back of this sheet on living toward God's future, I don't know whether it's living towards God's future in the present edition or towards the world's future. What is it called? On living toward the
future.
Living toward the future. If you look in the back sheet, last year when we were here, we had a forum on global citizenship, and out of that forum, I developed that sheet that talks about global citizenship, and it says every member of the church ought to somehow pick a third world country and attend to it. You can't attend to it. You can't even read a newspaper with it with any significance if you haven't got a focus. Otherwise, you don't learn about anything really, and you don't focus. Well, we're trying to relate to the Philippines, and we've got some people writing to church members in the church in the Philippines. We're trying to connect. The whole thing, of course, is connections, responsible connections, where you begin to feel the feelings of this third world. I went to Rio, and what I found in Rio was a world of the have-nots, a world of the have-nots that was really feeling very, very much separated from the so-called Christian world, very separated from it. Well, it's now what? It's now 11 o'clock. Well, let me just say a few things about what you hear if you listen to poverty and to racism. According to many authors, there's about 1.2 billion people in the world who live in absolute poverty. That means without minimum resources of food, clothing, shelter, let alone health care. Asia has 675 million, 25% of its population. Latin America, 150, 35%. Sub-Sahara, 325, 62% of its population. And North Africa and the Middle East, 75 million or 28%. That's a lot of people. And somehow, the world which we participate in and in which we are now thinking about participating in even much more with the global market being formed is a world of poverty. So these 1.2 billion now, in 2025, I figure, will be about 2 billion. By 2025, we'll have 8.46 billion people. So 23% of that is 1.947 billion in absolute poverty. I don't see anything to indicate that it will be less than that, and there's some indication it's going to be worse. In 1986-87, the United States dumped rice on the world market, reducing the price of rice from $8 a hundredweight to $4 a hundredweight. And 4 million Thai farmers lost half their income. And we subsidized our 19,000 rice farmers in the United States. The connections are inevitable. Our agricultural subsidies, our whole agricultural policy is involved in third world economic development. After studying this, I came up here in 89 and spent 21 months here doing nothing but studying this, and I haven't done anything since, and I'm simply convinced that there's no way for the world to have any kind of real future without third world economic development that takes into account these 1 to 2 billion people who are in poverty. And prediction is that there'll be all kinds of invasions from Indonesia into Australia, from Northern Africa into Europe, and of course from Mexico into our country. Meanwhile, 20% of our children grow up in poverty. 1 out of 5. 1 out of 2 African-American children in poverty. 2 out of 5 Hispanic children. And that takes us into the area of kind of special treatment of African-Americans and special disabilities. And according to this study of the Children's Defense Fund, it doesn't predict in any particular case, but half the kids who grow up in poverty are going to drop out of school. If you drop out of school, then you become part of the almost unemployables in terms of our present world. And then you move into the world that Cornel West is describing. Many black folk now reside in a jungle, ruled by a cutthroat market morality devoid of any faith in deliverance or hope for freedom. And the tragic response of the people bereft of resources in confronting the workings of United States society is what he calls nihilism. Horrifying meaninglessness, hopelessness, and most important, lovelessness. And results in a numbing detachment from other people. It's self-destructive, and it has a destructive outlook, disposition toward the world. So he says that it's not simply the African Americans, because in the Los Angeles riots, only, according to him, about a third of the people arrested were African Americans. So his point is that you can see in the way African Americans are responding, a kind of paradigm for the way people at the bottom are responding to the American society. The 1% of our people own 37% of the wealth. 10% of our people own 86% of the wealth. And it's the disparities are increasing. Since 73, the average weekly wages have fallen nearly 20%. Well, it seems like it's a little pessimistic. And the question then is, if you listen to this stuff, what do you do? Actually, there are more splits. I mean, you have the split between the black and the white, you have the split between the haves and the have-nots, and you have the split between what I call human nature, our concern for ourselves, and the concern for nature, simply interpreting that passage in Genesis, have dominion as having domination over the earth. So there's a real split. There's no essential meaning or purpose in the world of the non-human world except for our use. And you have the split between the gays and the lesbians and the straights, and the split between the men and the women, and what I call a split between the disrespected self in us and the respected self. And the more you look at what's happening in our life, the more you see that split. Defense Fund says that every day 1,849 children are abused. Every day 3,288 children run away from home. And it goes on, children born out of wedlock and born to teenagers and all this. The data is only important insofar as it causes one to stop and listen and look at what our society is about. And that's where this covenant comes in. I believe that I got some points here I probably ought to go over. The church is the bottom of the creation, and that's what I'm working for or thinking about or hoping to encourage and cultivate. The church is the embodiment of the creation whose reality is represented by Christ, moving in certain directions. The church will, first step is to say no. No to Western industrial culture. No to the notion of the isolated individual, and the notion that automatically, if you seek your own interests in the market, you will serve the interests of all. There's enough truth in it to take it very seriously. And I just taught a course on theology and the environment with a colleague at the university. And we used a book by Daly and Cobb, an alternative economics for community and for sustainable development. And I really struggled, because one of my best friends is in Eastern Europe right now, helping them understand how this market system, this economic way of thinking, will help them come out of the morass that they're in. But the morass that they're in a sense, unless they come out of it in a different way, will lead them to some of the things that we're in. So it's clear that the social ownership of the means of production isn't going to solve the problem. Their environment is worse than ours in Eastern Europe, and their human conditions are almost as bad. So I think somehow or other we have to start with the notion that salvation is communal, that we're all in it together. And I think we've got to say no. And I've got this little article on why we should buy less. You know, we should buy less, and it's not easy to buy less. And when we were here, I decided I wasn't going to buy anything for my wife's birthday. And you know, birthday and Christmas, you've got to buy something. And I'm trying to do it, so I painted her a couple of pictures. And they, you know, I've done a lot of painting, and it's not very good probably, but it's hanging all over our house. So she at least appreciates it. Anyway, she got home, sent our son down to the frame-up. $53.15 for the frame-up. Well, you know, I really enjoy looking at them in our living room. But you can't win. I mean, I went to Rio, and I said, you can't go to Holden last year unless you go by train. I went on the plane, and I flew back to Los Angeles, and my grandson was being married, and I could have taken the train, but I couldn't get there for the supper the night before, you know. So I flew to, La Jolla? That isn't quite the name. What is it? It's just south of San Francisco. Anyway, San Jose, is that right? Yeah. Anyway, it's very hard to do this. And this time, she wanted to drive out here. And I said, well, only on one condition, that you buy a new car, which I frequently said, if you can buy a car that gets 40, 50 miles a gallon, you're driving one that gets 10 or 20 or even 25. You ought to buy the car. It's a sin. It's not a sin if you don't buy that car. I said that up here once. It's kind of crazy, you know. So we got a Honda Civic. You know, it's small. It's a little dangerous compared to a big car. I know all the facts. I've read on the rollover possibilities and all that sort of stuff. And we didn't get too good mileage, so I'm feeling a little bit convicted. Well, we got 37 or 40 miles per gallon. I mean, we didn't get bad mileage. But how do you win this game? I don't know how you win this game. I say you got to move in the direction. And I think we need to take that covenant and try to find a group of people who will look at it seriously. And you know, it really means something. I stopped eating meat up here in 89. But you know, I'm not for returning to rural. I mean, I got a triple bypass. I'm aware of what medical technology has done for my life. I'm not simply saying return. Appropriate in a way that deals with our relatedness with each other. And that takes a mite of doing. I mean, it isn't a simple kind of thing. There isn't a simple no. I mean, you can't live with an absolute no. There's no way to live without these ambiguities. But the question is, and I have the study here, and this is somewhat what I mean. The study which says, with energy efficiency, and it shows it's got a program for it, you know, certain tax on carbon emissions of $25 a ton of CO2, $92 a ton of carbon, which, and other things, but that's just suggestive, which will cut our use of fossil fuels in half by 2025. 2030 it is. And then if we support, as we could, renewable energy, I mean wind is now competitive per kilowatt, cost per kilowatt, with coal and gas and oil, you could cut it another half. So you can reduce the amount of carbon dioxide going up in the atmosphere by 70% by 2030 with a program. I mean, it's possible. And why don't we do it? All I'm saying is, if the churches really take seriously the fact that we belong to each other, and in some sense we're connected to the non-human world, and the character of that non-human world is important to us and important to God, we will become involved. And it involves the politics. I mean, there's no way out of it, so far as I can see, except a kind of politics. And but as you can see, Clinton's problem, what's he suggesting? 4.33 cents a gallon tax. I mean, it's no tax at all. Gas in Europe costs you $3 or $4. The Europeans somehow have been able to move more toward a politics that involves their care of and relation to the rest of the world, the rest of their people, and the rest of the world. And we can have all kinds of arguments as to whether it's successful or not. But I say, in part, it's successful in because of the kind of Lutheran Christian background in, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, and they've got problems. They've got alcoholism too, and kind of meaninglessness because they got everything. You're taken care of, and then what do you do? At any rate, that's enough for me to say.
You were speaking about the population explosion, and I've often thought that maybe we should limit the amount of children that we have in our country. But look, isn't it ironic to think that the Chinese are coming over here because they can only have two children in your country, and
it's one? The Europeans would say we ought to think about it. According to my statistics, by 2025, we will increase 50 million. We'll increase from 250 to 300 million. That's a prediction. And you could say, the Europeans would argue, you ought to cut your population because you use so much of the resources of the world. In other words, we use more of the resources, and we give off more of the pollutions. We give off a quarter of the carbon dioxide pollutions with about 5.61% of the people. We give off 23-24% of the carbon. So they say we ought to, we do so much more to the world with each person we have. That's the Chinese, actually. I've got here somewhere their figure. It's a little disconcerting to look at the reality of the rest of the world in terms of their population increase. Probably won't turn it up. But the Chinese are going to increase their population from 1.1 trillion to about 1.4 trillion by 2025. So they haven't stopped the population growth. The only place in the world where the population is even level or less than level is in Europe. And all the theories say if you educate women and if you give them economic advantages and you provide economic security in the country, and you provide with a kind of status for women, you get rid of the macho attitudes that are in some cultures about men, that and you give them the birth control, that the population will decrease. Women don't want children. It's the generalization generally in those countries. But, you know, part of the reason they have the children is so many die. That said, I don't know whether that's true. Now, how do you get inside a person and know what's going on? But my thesis is that third world economic development is the key to the reduction of population explosion. Third world. And in one Scientific American, it calculated what we would need to spend as a collective society to bring this off. It was somewhere not quite $1 trillion in the next. This was in 89, I think, that the prediction was made. $1 trillion in the next 10 years. But of course, we're not spending $1 trillion. We haven't. Al Gore calls for a global Marshall Plan, and I believe he's right, that the future of everybody, actually, and particularly our kids and our grandkids, is in acting as if we belong to the rest of the world and being intelligent about how we carry that out and being active politically in order to get it done together. What you do in detail? No. I'm thinking about organizing Jesse Jackson to organize the Greens of the world to negotiate with the transnational corporations to have policies that are friendly toward the environment. I don't know. You know, I negotiated with him for 7 years in corporate America for affirmative action. I know that you've got good leadership in corporate America that responds with a little bit of pressure to rational proposals for dealing with issues. They do. They just do. Some more than others. But it takes a little bit of organization, a little bit of pressure. It has to make some sense. So you've got your vote and you got your consuming dollar. And you can have a little bit of disruptive activity, but that's not really going to be effective, I think, in the long run. So you've got your vote and your consuming dollar, and you can use your dollars, if they're organized, to put a little pressure in certain directions. What one has to do is to listen to the world long enough and focused enough to have some ideas about some directions and get enough consensus. That problem of consensus is always there. But I don't know.
I was in the former Soviet Union months ago, and they had an article in the paper, have more children.
They did what?
They had an article in the newspapers saying, have more children.
Oh, have. Where was this?
In Latvia.
In Latvia. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the third world, or the developing world, or the newly freed world, and the African Americans here think that, you know, there's a whole nationalist movement in African Americans that says the only way we're going to make it is to organize ourselves for ourselves. And in order to become not a minority, we got to have more children.
Exactly.
And therefore it makes sense for us, power thinking, power wise, to have more children. So,
yeah, but even the Russians don't have children.
Yeah.
Allie, now I listened to you, and you have done a lot of research and writing and reading and proclaiming and doing, you know, very responsible. So you're not talking just out of the blue sky. But eventually, if this gets very heavy, and the pessimism and the outlook is bleak, and there is no way out, no exit. If there is no exit, no matter how you do it, no matter how rationally you approach it, the future is bleak and there is no hope. Now, then the reaction can be quite simple, cynical.
Yeah, no. Live for today.
What's the use? You know, there was a rock group in the early 60s who said, let's die so that we don't die old, or something to that effect.
Yeah,
now, the same fellow coming out and saying a little bit different tune and different words, he's coming out. But isn't there something, I mean, you need to have hope.
Oh, well,
and
I think...
hope cannot be simply built on something that we, so to say, concoct ourselves.
You see,
hope has to come from out. Somehow God get to get involved so that this, even Jeremiah, who was, you know, we have even speak about Jeremiah, that is a hopeless type of thing. Even he speaks about hope in the midst of all the dismal situation. I know from our country's history, a general of the Ivan the Terrible, he went back to Moscow and reported that the area where we were born and lived, that you can drive for kilometers and kilometers and you don't hear a rooster sing, you know, crow. Plague and the destruction, military destruction. Now from that perspective, at that particular time in history, in that particular spot, it seems that there is no use. Because, you know, the evidence is clear what to talk about. There's nothing, no hope. But somehow, you know, our projections, no matter how profound they are not the...
That's right. That's right. The God has...
In charge.
Plans.
And unless that word comes in after you have read all the newspapers and all the reports and all the projections which are all pointing toward no exit, there need to be counter force and counter message.
That's why I claim this is the voice of God. And you can read in the Old Testament where God uses the natural world to say something about how we're living. I claim it's judgment. That all this pessimism is judgment. Out of judgment, however, connected with judgment comes grace. That is to say, there's going to be a remnant. There will be a remnant. It's just like the flood. In some sense, this state of the world is like the flood. It's going to destroy a lot, and it's going to cause a lot of havoc. But out of it will come. And in some ways, I think we have to form communities based on this covenant. If I were younger, I would be looking for 5,000 acres and 2,500 people, and I would be saying, we will be a light unto the future. We will live as if 10 billion people could live this way. We will be a light. God's light, in terms of what God wants us to do, granted we take the position about the way everything is connected to each other and our responsibility to the world. That's where I am. And if somebody offered me 5,000 acres, a nice lake and a river running through, not a river, no, not anymore, but a lake, you know, and fairly decent land, I think I would jump.
But isn't it true that no matter how you look at it, Amish people froze the history in one point in our civilization? And there would be another layer, would not be called Amish, but it would be called something. And that community freeze in a certain kind of a level too.
Could be.
Yeah, because that's what Amish people is. I mean, I can laugh at it and we can laugh at it, but really they're pointing in some direction that we need to look more.
Other than support in a situation like that, aren't we better off in the total population having some movement and spreading ideas? And
In my book, it's a terrible last chapter on this. I mean, I'm very unhappy with it, but in the book I say that you got to work in two directions. I am going to work on Jesse to change the general life direction of our society. You know, by organizing people who kind of see things the way this environmental movement sees things. I don't know whether he'll buy into that. At the same time, I'm going to work for the creation of what I call eschatological communities, communities that live in the way the future needs to be. So I say you got to work in both directions. You got to be realistic. I'm very much a realist in terms of, if you haven't got the power, you're not going to move most corporations if you don't have some power. I understand many people only move when their self-interests are affected, and you've got to deal with that, and therefore you've got to use market mechanisms insofar as you can. You can't just appeal to their goodwill to buy cars to get big mileage. You got to make the price of gasoline such that they will buy cars that get good mileage. But so I would say you got to work in both directions. I see us in somewhat of a period like the Middle Ages, where you had the monasteries. Now the it's not a withdrawal for the sake of oneself. It's a withdrawal for the sake of mission. And that's where I'd be different, I think, from the Amish. In other words, I wouldn't withdraw just for the sake of living for myself. I would withdraw for the sake of mission to the world, God's mission to the world. And people are withdrawing, of course, but I don't see much that's attractive. There have been a couple of proposals that move in the direction I've got the idea, actually, from a German a green person, Rudolf Barrow, who stole it from the Hopis. His 2,500 is a Hopi figure for a kind of a and you know what, I know you can't withdraw, and I used the illustration of you can't withdraw, and with 2,500 people you're not going to have the technology to do this bypass. Of course they say there are other technologies now that are, but still, the technology is there. That's the one thing in technology. I can do without the television. I haven't turned the television on since December 27th, 1978. But I can do without a lot of the technology, but the medical technology is, even though I know it's kind of demonic, I mean, they spent thousands of dollars on me recently, and with no result whatsoever, and they just do it because they have the technology, and because they're afraid, sometimes they're afraid of a suit, so they will put you through a whole series of things that you don't need to be put through, and you don't know enough, or they don't give you a chance even to say no. If you had to pay for it, of course, you might say no. And that's another whole health care is unbelievably complex.
An example.
Big pardon?
I see education of young people and example as being one way.
Well, education, of course, is chiefly to get you to be a cog in this machine. And education ought to be introduction into a way of being and meaning. And it ought to introduce you into the kinds of materials that I've been working on, so that you see the ambiguity of our life, and you don't just rush in to be a cog in this machine. And I mean, the universities for the most part are creating cogs. Now there's some work going on at the university in the direction that I'm interested in, and that seems to raise these questions with people about what the meaning of the civilization is and about where to locate oneself. But for the most part, they're preparing people to be effective instruments in the economic machine.
I'm on the other end of it. I'm in elementary education. And you can do some idealism. You can do some things in this way, whether that carries through over the years.
Yeah, well, you're in a spot to introduce this book, Voice of the Earth, by Theodore Rotsak, claims that children have a kind of a natural animism, that is a natural relationship to the environment, to the natural world, that it's there, and that we educate them, or we isolate them from it, and somehow we have to encourage it, that is, we have to have our education...